Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Jessica Ahrens will be on to talk about the newest developments in the House bills to restrict abortion and contraception funding. Also, anti-choicers get a little bolder in coming out in support of terrorism, and Lila Rose continues to be a dud. Eric Bollert of Media Matters went on MSNBC to talk about the Planned Parenthood hoax run by Lila Rose.
And I think the good news is the progressives and Democrats learned from Acorn. They had no backbone when Acorn came along. They capitulated. They ran like as fast as they could. They've seen this movie before, and they realize there's really no there, which is the good news.
Tons and tons of credit to Media Matters for being on top of this from the beginning and doing tremendous work and taking the knees off of it. Last week, I reported on the massive move against abortion and contraception funding from anti-choicers on the Hill. Now it's time to talk about how the past month has also ushered in a surprisingly new turn towards violence with anti-choicers. Even though it's been less than 2 years since Dr. George Tiller was murdered in cold blood by an anti-choice activist, it seems that anti-choicers aren't going to tone it down. In fact, they seem emboldened on many levels, starting right in Wichita, where Dr. Tiller was murdered.
In December, the Associated Press reported that two Wichita doctors were training to provide abortion services. The doctors' names were leaked to the press by the anti-abortion movement, and the AP inexplicably decided to publish them, even though it did not necessarily advance the story. The protests at the doctors' offices against them potentially providing abortions at some point in the future started immediately. And after a lawsuit filed by her landlord, one of these two doctors is now looking for another facility to move to, one where she'll be able to set up enough security to be able to provide this supposedly constitutionally protected legal service.
Terrorism works. That's why people do it. Rachel interviewed the doctor who had been targeted by this harassment and violence campaign, which includes threats in the form of the wanted posters that float around before many doctors have been shot, including Dr. Tiller. She's incredibly brave, and she doesn't seem flustered by these turns of event, as most of us would be.
I think I'm holding up well. My decision is I had too many patients since Dr. Tiller's murder who were unable to get their legally rightful services if they were having a pregnancy that was causing their life and their health problems.
As for these, the threats that you have received, and I see these emails as threats. These ones from these guys responsible for the wanted posters in North Carolina. What did you think when you first saw this email? I saw it as a threat to you. Did you see it that way as well?
Yes, I think there are clear threats.
It's easy to blame the landlord in this situation for holding the doctor responsible for the threats that are actually coming from pro-terrorism, anti-choice protesters, but we should be looking to the law instead. It's the job of the government to keep the peace and to control terrorism, and not private citizens like landlords. Instead, however, there are some in the government that are siding with the terrorists. In South Dakota, a group of Republican legislators managed to get a bill out of committee with a 9-3 party line vote that would make it legal for anyone with a familial relation to the potential child in a pregnancy to kill someone to stop that fetus from being hurt or destroyed. The legislators swear it had nothing to do with abortion, but brought mostly anti-abortion groups to testify about it. They claim it's to give pregnant women the right to self-defense, but pregnant women already have it. Another interpretation, the more valid one, is that this is their love letter to Scott Roeder, the man who killed Dr. Tiller and tried to use justifiable homicide as his defense. Of course, there was no legal reason to allow that defense, so he got the book thrown at him. South Dakota legislators are responding by trying to write a law that says that it is justifiable homicide, you know, if you're the man who impregnated her, which fits into the common anti-choice fantasy of a man forcibly removing his pregnant wife or girlfriend from an abortion clinic to save his baby. Jill from Feminist, who is a lawyer, went on the Alana show to explain the legal possibilities here.
which does to me imply that it could possibly apply to abortion providers. Or at the very least, that if somebody did kill an abortion provider who was going to be providing that service for, you know, his wife or his child or whatever other family member or relation the bill covers, that this is something that he could, you know, reasonably introduce in court as a defense. And given that it's on the books, you know, it could lead a judge to be more inclined to allow that defense to appear before a jury.
The context here is that justifiable homicide is something anti-choice extremists have been angling for forever when it comes to defending those who shoot abortion doctors. This is something Rachel Maddow touched on Tuesday night when warming our audience up to their future coverage of hearings to disbar anti-choice nut Phil Klein. She touched on the murder of Dr. Tiller and how there was an attempt to get a justifiable homicide defense accepted, which was rejected.
In South Dakota today, there's been national attention to a bill that would call it justifiable homicide to kill someone who would try to harm a fetus. The bill's author says this has nothing to do with abortion whatsoever. Anti-abortion extremists who have killed and physically attacked abortion providers over the last 20 years, of course, have argued in court again and again that they see the killing of abortion doctors as justifiable homicide. The South Dakota bill was supposed to be voted on today. It has been put off until tomorrow. The reason it's causing so much consternation is the fear that this will be yet another dog whistle from the supposed mainstream anti-abortion movement to those on the radical edge of the movement who have proven time and time again that they will kill to get their way and who are unrepentant about it when they have done it.
And that's something to consider. Even if no judge would really allow this defense, even after the South Dakota bill was passed, there's more to consider than just how anti-choice nuts handle their defense after they kill someone. There's also the prevention angle. We don't want it to get to that point, but now you have state governments kicking the term justifiable homicide around when they know there are legions of anti-choice extremists out there who are eager to hear their views reaffirmed, and who could take this as a signal that killing is what's expected and desired of them. The good news is that the wide outcry meant the bill was pulled back. So keep at it, folks. Sometimes you win. I'd like to welcome Jessica Ahrens to the program. Jessica is the director of the Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress, and she's been working steadily on the fight against the anti-choice bills percolating through the House. She's here today to talk about some of those bills, especially H.R. 3 and H.R. 358. These would strip most women of insurance coverage for abortion in the U.S. Thank you for coming on to RealityCast, Jessica.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so I've been covering these bills for a couple weeks on the show, but just to sort of refresh, what would H.R. 3 and H.R. 358 do if they went into law?
All right. At the kernel of it, H.R. 358, which was introduced by Representative Joe Pitts of Jack Pitts fame, it would basically reinvigorate the Stupak Amendment from last year. It would pretty much exclude any private insurance coverage of abortion within the state healthcare exchanges and the multi-state exchanges that are being set up by 2014 under the Affordable Care Act. There are some other things that the Pitts bill would do that I think we can get into in a little while, but that's the kind of the essence of it. H.R. 3, so named because it is the third piece of legislation and therefore a high priority of the House majority, was introduced by Representative Chris Smith from New Jersey, a longtime abortion foe. It is incredibly expansive. He talks about it as codifying the Hyde Amendment, which means it would make it permanent, the ban on federal funding for abortion in the Medicaid program and in a number of other government insurance programs. However, that alone would be bad enough, but it also does much more than that. It basically redefines this concept of government funding to include things like our tax benefits and would do things like eliminate employer-based insurance coverage of abortion from a large section of the employer market. It would also prevent people who can deduct medical expenses on their taxes, from it would prevent them from being able to include abortion care or any health plan that includes abortion coverage in those deductions. And so it does that kind of thing. Then it also has its own version of the STUPAC amendment. And it changes the law in 7 or 8 different ways. I mean, those are kind of the top line changes that it would make. But there are a number of things that it would do to kind of expand this policy of what they call no federal funds for abortions. But it's a very expansive definition of federal funding of abortion, to say the least.
Well, and they've been saying that when pressed about it by journalists, most of the Republicans that are working on this bill have been saying that it's no big deal, that it's being made too big a deal out of. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, I think they're trying to minimize it and downplay it in order to keep it palatable and try to get it passed. Unfortunately, we don't have the numbers to stop it in the House, so it will pass in the House probably no matter what we do. We could set ourselves on fire in protest, they'll still pass it. But the idea is kind of whether they can get it through the Senate, whether they can kind of, pull the wool over enough people's eyes and make them think, oh, it's not that bad, and it's pretty much the policy that the, government has had for a really long time, and so it's not really changing anything. And that's just blatantly untrue. I mean, this kind of goes into a number of areas where they haven't gone before. They've never gone after the tax code before in trying to restrict abortion access. And basically what they're doing is they're under the rubric of no federal funding for abortion, they're trying to eliminate all coverage of abortion, whether through public or private insurance sources. So they're trying to make abortion unaffordable and out of reach for as many women as possible.
And what are some of the other things that the Pitts bill would do?
Well, one of the interesting things, so with both of these bills, originally they were trying to redefine the rape exception, and of course that's gotten a lot of attention, so I'm sure most of your audience has already heard about that. It would limit the exception for rape to cases of quote-unquote forcible rape, and one of the problems with that was that there was no definition of forcible rape, so who knows when that would even apply. But it was certainly intended to eliminate any coverage for victims of statutory rape, maybe someone who was drugged or anyone who just didn't fight hard enough, I suppose. So there was all of that. And they said that they would, after all the pushback that they received on that and all the outrage people expressed, they said that they would go back to the kind of standard definition of rape. And the Pitts bill was reintroduced with that standard definition. The Smith bill, H.R. 3, still has not been changed, still includes the forcible rape provision. So the Pitts bill, I suppose, is a little bit better now with that. On the other hand, when they reintroduced that bill with the standard rape exception, they changed other language in the bill that makes it even more problematic than before. And that's with a section on conscience rights for providers who don't want to provide abortion care, who don't want to provide information about abortion services or counseling or referrals for abortions. And they amended it. What this bill would do is have the effect of amending a statute referred in shorthand as EMTALA, but it's a law that requires hospitals to stabilize anyone and provide life-saving care in an emergency. And the Pitts bill would create an exception to that when it comes to abortion. And so it would basically allow hospitals to let women die if they needed an abortion and the hospital didn't want to provide one. So that's what we're looking at there.
So the term forcible rape was also in the Smith bill, right?
It is in the Smith bill. It has not been removed. Yep.
Oh, okay. So because when there was a big to-do over it being removed a couple weeks ago, but they just reneged on that promise?
Yeah, they said that they would take it out, and they haven't. And they certainly have the chance to do that. And we'll see. The bill has not been through a markup process yet, which is a process where amendments are offered and the bill is debated in committee. And so it's possible that they would do it in committee. On the other hand, with the Pitts bill, H.R. 358, they didn't wait until committee to remove it. They did take the opportunity to amend it and reintroduce it before that markup process began. So there's nothing stopping Representative Smith from changing his bill and taking out the forcible rape provision. He just hasn't done it yet. He just hasn't gotten around to it, I suppose.
Well, and while those bills are already like a big deal, then a third one, dark horse anti-choice bill, is kind of pulled out and gotten a lot of attention, and that's a bill being floated by Mike Pence that would eliminate family planning funding under Title X, which is basically being done as a direct attack on Planned Parenthood. What's your read on this bill standing? Is it going to pass?
Well, Representative Pence has done a few different things. First of all, he did introduce a standalone bill, like you said, to eliminate Title X family planning funding for any recipients who use private money to provide abortion care. And he's done it with, like you said, he's made no bones about it. It's about trying to defund Planned Parenthood. Then, recently, just yesterday or the day before, he filed an amendment to the continuing resolution, which is the way that the government funds the way Congress funds the government's budget when it hasn't actually passed an official budget. Anyway, that amendment specifically targets Planned Parenthood and would take away all federal funding for Planned Parenthood, both in the Title X program, through Medicaid, or through any other kind of government funding that Planned Parenthood currently gets. And again, all of these dollars are used for things like family planning services and contraception, for prenatal care, for HIV testing, for pap smears, for infertility counseling. I mean, it's a whole host of reproductive health care services that Planned Parenthood provides to millions of men and women around the country. And it's really a safety net provider, and it's serving communities that often have nowhere else to go. A large percentage of their clientele are uninsured, live below the poverty line. And he's going after all the money that Planned Parenthood receives from the government to provide these services. In addition to those two attacks from Mike Pence, the House majority also has, in the underlying bill itself for the continuing resolution, has zeroed out money for the Title X family planning program. So regardless of whether you're Planned Parenthood or someone else, there would be no money left for this program that has been in place since the 70s, that was first passed under President Nixon. And it has just been kind of an incredibly important piece of our healthcare safety net for decades, and the Republican majority is trying to get rid of it altogether, just completely eliminate it.
And what's the reasoning for it? Are they whipping out the fiscal conservatism card?
Right. I mean, they're saying that they need to cut all these entitlement programs and government spending. We need to reduce the deficit. And of course, they'd rather reduce the deficit on the backs of poor women than on the backs of their wealthy contributors on Wall Street. So that's where we see it. And we see them also, they've also gone after family planning in the international budget as well for women around the world. Again, this is not, this is kind of maybe penny wise and pound foolish. As you probably know, family planning dollars are incredibly cost effective. They save the government almost $4 for every $1 spent in family planning services, because, you're preventing unintended pregnancy, you're preventing the need for prenatal care and delivery and labor and postnatal care for women who don't want to be pregnant. It's one thing if women want to be pregnant, want to carry to term, need the supports, want to raise their children, and need some assistance from the government, and we should be providing that. But when they don't want to be pregnant, when they're not feeling like they can have a child or another child, why are we putting them in a position where they aren't able to prevent those pregnancies? And I should say one last thing in the meantime is, in the continuing resolution, they've also targeted funding for women who are pregnant or who are raising or who have infants. They've cut the budget for WIC, the Women, Infant, and Children program, which is a nutrition program for pregnant and nursing mothers. They've cut the maternal child health care block grant, which is, again, money that poor women and their families rely on for receiving basic health care services. So, I mean, no matter where you look, they're leaving women with nowhere to go. They're, you know, taking away the resources to prevent unintended pregnancy, to have an abortion, or to, you know, carry to term, give birth, and raise children with dignity. So it's just an all-out war on women as far as I'm concerned.
My guest today has been Jessica Ahrens, and she's working on behalf of the Center for American Progress. She's been doing great work keeping track of this ridiculous amount of anti-choice legislation that's out there. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Jessica.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
The Lila Rose situation has only gotten more bizarre since I last reported on it. The problem for Rose is that what she set out to prove was that Planned Parenthood goes along with sex trafficking. What happened was she proved the opposite. When Planned Parenthood alerted the authorities to people in their offices claiming to be pimps working with underage girls, a person with dignity and a shred of decency would immediately drop the whole thing when presented with such a problem. But then again, a person with dignity and decency doesn't get into anti-choice activism. Rose knew she could count on the conservative media to proceed as if she'd proven something she hadn't. And frankly, that often works. The past few years have seen many right-wing hoaxes work even though they were quite obviously fake, because they can count on the mainstream media to help them. But this time, the hoax seemed DOA. Was it because it's so obviously a lie? I doubt it. There's not many right-wing lies that don't get sympathetic play in the mainstream media. I think a lot of it has to do with the Egyptian protests drowning this story out. But it was also that Planned Parenthood, with a big assist from Media Matters and the pro-choice community, got ahead of this story, leaving conservatives who thought this would work so well in an incoherent, sputtering rage.
She's taken a lot of heat, too, from these feminist messiahs who make their living advocating for women while also fighting for female genocide. These feminist messiahs. It's infuriating. These are women they talk about being independent and self-sustaining and empowered, but you're not empowered when you're expecting Uncle Sam to act like your sugar daddy and take care of your abortions and take care of your birth control and pay your bills and everything else. That's not empowerment. What empowerment is what Lila Rose has done.
That was Dana Loesch, who is unfortunately allowed to offer analysis on CNN, ranting at CPAC. I particularly enjoyed how she took a swipe at my last name. Are right-wing nuts back to hating anything that sounds French again? I can never keep up. But really, that was an elegant display of ignorant, sputtering rage, screaming the evils of birth control and then screaming about the evils of social spending. Every reasonable study you can imagine demonstrates that helping women prevent unwanted childbirth saves us money, because women who can't afford the $400 for an abortion generally are going to need assistance for the childbirth and child rearing. And of course, lashing out at professional writers and pundits for having jobs and then lashing out at us for supposedly making the government pay for our healthcare? Pick. Seriously. Are we bad people for having jobs and paying our own way? Or are we bad people because we're supposedly on the dole? It's one or the other, because it can't be both. Anyway, the point is that this is where things are. They're whipping crowds into frenzies of hate aimed at young women for daring to believe we have a right to live our lives. We're evil for having jobs, for having sex, for believing we're people with rights. That they've gotten young women who fit the model of the hate object to speak the hate is just a clever PR move, but let's not be fooled into seeing this for what it is. Glenn Beck tried to give Lila Rose an opportunity to salvage all this stupidity. She decided to replace analysis with telling lurid stories.
Harsh and brutal reality is these children are being serially raped, these children are being enslaved, these children are are sometimes locked away in dog kennels. There's a story in ABC News about a girl that was locked in a dog kennel, and then she would be serially raped by people all around the city. I mean, these stories are atrocious. So the idea that their pimps could be coming into Planned Parenthood clinics, walking in casually, doing business as usual with the staff, even though he's self-proclaiming that he's had these sex slaves, picking up a bag of condoms, walking back to the jail, to the place where he's keeping his slaves captive and having them serially raped, and that Planned Parenthood can get away with that, that that's okay with people, I don't think anyone would say that that's okay.
The reason to go off on that litany was, besides the usual Glenn Beck mission of convincing the audience that the world outside their door is a war zone, it's to imply that Planned Parenthood somehow assists or supports this. On the contrary, what Rose really doesn't want to talk about is that after her actors got their jollies pretending to be the kind of people who rape young girls, Planned Parenthood alerted the authorities because they oppose sex trafficking.
The reality here is Planned Parenthood is a mandated reporter for sexual abuse. It's their obligation legally, Glenn. If somebody walks in and if they in any way suspect child abuse, they have to make an immediate report. And that's because our legal system is structured to protect children from sexual abuse, not to patch it up with secret abortions and condoms, which ultimately facilitate more abuse, but to rescue these children by making an immediate report to people that can help them.
Yep, they are a mandated reporter, and when they were informed of child abuse, they reported it to the authorities. But I want to draw attention to the second part of this, where Rose makes her real interests clear. She screeches about how condoms and abortion cover up the crime, but by doing so, she exposes that all her supposed concern for rape victims is a lie. When you're a victim, being told that you should die of AIDS or be forced to bear a rapist child in order to prove something is unbelievably cruel. People who actually care about rape victims, such as Planned Parenthood and the pro-choice movement, want to make sure victims are cared for. The callous way that Rose wishes disease, forcible childbirth, and even death on victims of rape and trafficking is stunning. Pro-life, my ass.
When I get down, you know I get down. When I get around, you know.
And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts, feel the hypocrisy edition. Andrew Breitbart, looking quite disheveled at CPAC, said this.
We started to realize what the game was here because the Code Pink ladies, because they're tedious at this point, you know, and boring. It's no longer fun to watch them, and they're not even good looking anymore. It used to be that they were like kind of slutty lefties, and you know, and you're like, oh, I could imagine at a bar.
Women who make the choice to be sexual were the object of Dana Loesch's whipping the crowd into a frenzy of hate. But men making the choice to pick women up in bars? Just adorable. Thanks, CPAC, for the reminder that this is and always has been about misogyny and the double standard.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.